Okay, we're going to pick up, I guess, approximately where we left off. Dr. Peter Sandman is going to continue his talk.
Okay.
You want to maybe see if we have some questions before we?
Yeah, let's see if there are any, and
resume.
If not, then I'll move on down the road.
All right. Everybody's
signing in.
I don't see any questions per se. I don't know, I guess I'll just get rolling, and if something arises, we can address it.
Okay.
As the questions come in.
Okay. In that case, Zach, can we move to the next slide? Okay. This is the advanced course. The introductory course that I just moved away from, again, to remind you after lunch, was first listen, then echo, then ask questions, then find things to agree with, and then find things to voice reservations about. And those reservations are still not crap rebuttal. They're still, yes and or yes but, not just, you're dead wrong. Now, the advanced course is not sequential. So it's not like then cultivate an empathic attitude. Number 6 through 11 are very difficult things that you try to do throughout your interaction with people who are upset with you. And the first one, number 6, is to cultivate an empathic attitude. This is very hard. And the reason why it's hard is worth noticing. It's hard mostly because when people are outraged at you, the odds are overwhelming that you are also outraged at them. In 40 odd years of working with clients, trying to help my clients calm an outraged public, one of the most consistent things I encountered is my client was very attentive to how outraged their public was, but not nearly attentive enough to how outraged they were. Their pretense, even to themselves, it's not like they were lying to me, their pretense even to themselves was, I'm not angry, I'm just right. I'm not upset, I'm just doing my job. But the reality is, when people are angry at you and getting in the way of you doing your job and arguing that you're doing your job all wrong and how dare you let this horrible pesticide be used in my environment and what kind of awful person are you to let this happen, there would be something wrong with you if you were able to take that all on board without any emotional reaction of your own. And there isn't anything wrong with you. So odds are when people are angry at you, you are angry back at them. The difference is typically an angry public, an angry attentive feels entitled to act angry and to sound angry so that they're hot. Whereas if you're an official, you probably feel like you're not supposed to be angry. So while their anger is hot, your anger is cold. So we get the sort of classic unempathic interaction between an outraged public and a passive aggressive official, where they're sounding angrier and angrier, and that makes you colder and colder, and that makes them angrier, and that makes you colder. There's a gender link to this. It's likeliest to go wrong if they're women and you're men, and you wind up accusing them of hysteria, which is a gender-loaded term for outrage. But even if you're all of the same gender, this conflict between the cold official and the hot public is a very, very common phenomenon. Now, I'm not urging you to get hot, although, in fact, honest anger is often more empathic than cold passive aggression. But with any luck at all, you can do even better than getting angry right back. And looking for ways to cope with your own outrage is a very big piece of cultivating an empathic attitude. And, you know, I mean, the classic advice that we've all learned, count to 10, take a bathroom break. I have spent a fair amount of time consulting with officials who have to run public meetings. And I've urged my client, if they need a break, if they need to, you know, call a 10-minute recess, call it. And if they need it for emotional reasons, say so. You know, that, I mean, that's very humanizing to say, you know, gee, I'm, you know, this is very hard for me to hear, and it's important for you to tell me these things, but I'm getting either hot under the collar, you know, or I feel like I'm at risk of crying because you're attacking me so horribly. Can I just have a 10-minute break, please? And you know, and I'll get gather my emotional resources and get my act together a little bit, and then, you know, let's just continue right where we let off. You know, so I mean, you know, those kinds of things are useful. I think perhaps the single most important thing to do to cope with your own outrage at your outraged publics is to have someone you can safely vent to. They are venting to you, and you don't really want to vent back. But you need to be able to vent somewhere. So whether that's a spouse or whether it's somebody in the human relations department, you know, you need an opportunity to vent. It's been kind of amazing to me that organizations can say to an official, you know, to somebody who works for the agency, okay, you know, do your day job all day, and then go to a public meeting at night, and for, you know, from 7 o'clock in the evening until 11 o'clock in the evening, get attacked. And then go home and try to sleep and be back in the office at 8 o'clock, ready to do your day job again. No opportunity to decaffect, which is the psychological term for venting your own outrage. I mean, that's an unreasonable demand. If you've got to work at public meetings, you're going to, at angry public meetings, you're going to need somebody you can decaffect with. And maybe that's a job for HR to take on board, to give you an opportunity the next morning to talk about what jerks some of those people in the public were last night. I had a client years ago that worked out a formal way to do this, and I'm not recommending this because it ain't going to look good if people discover you're doing it. But what they did, and this was a call center, this was the people I was working with spent their entire day every day fielding phone calls from angry people. It was for a railway company, and you know, the call center people were just taking calls all day from angry people, and you know, they had a very hard time staying empathic and staying, you know, not venting back. So what they did is they established an asshole of the week contest. Again, I'm not recommending this because, you know, it doesn't look good, but it worked quite well, partly because it was good for morale. Instead of being, you know, unhappy when you got a particularly irritating call, you started getting excited about, yay, I may win the contest this week. But not only that, if you were going to enter the call in the contest, you had to handle it well. So they found that people were not venting back. They were staying empathic so that they could enter the call in the contest. You know, whatever it takes to cultivate that empathic attitude is going to stand you in good stead if you can do it. Number seven is to find a middle ground between obliviousness and obtrusiveness. And I think I've covered this enough already. You know, the usual problem is obliviousness. The usual problem is pretending to yourself that the substance of their concern is the whole sum total of their concern, and that there's no outrage that you have to address. So realizing that, yeah, they're outraged and I need to address the outrage, that's halfway to empathy. You can't afford to go too far. You can't address the outrage too intrusively. You can't say, I can tell you're really pissed off at me, because, you know, you don't have permission to tell people how you can tell how they feel. So finding that middle ground is important. One way of finding that middle ground, and I've covered this as well already, is to practice deflection. The basic level is you, to talk about you, and that's undeflected and therefore very intrusive. And talking about yourself, to change it from I to you. I felt this way once when something like this happened to me, is deflected. More deflected is they to a third party. I talked to someone last week and here's what she was upset about. Make it more general. Some people is even more deflected, and make it abstract. It often happens that is the most deflected. The advantage of deflection is that it provokes less denial. If you label people's fears, if you tell them how they feel, they are very likely to deny that they feel that way, and that gets in the way of addressing the outrage. So it makes it easier to keep the issue on the table, or if not on the table, at least in the room, if you address it deflectedly, than if you address it too directly in a way that's too intrusive. Number nine, and this is something I haven't gotten to before, express hopes, fears, regrets, wishes, and worries. You notice those are all things about you, not about them. Two of them are positive, the hopes and the wishes, and three are negative, the fears and regrets and worries. I like the positive ones better on the whole, but all of them are humanizing. You're not just a representative of your agency. You're a person. You actually have hopes and fears and regrets and wishes and worries. Now, it's even better if they're the same ones as your audience has. If you're able to express honestly a hope or a fear or a regret that is one that they are experiencing, that's even better. That establishes your commonality. But any expression of your own hopes and fears and regrets and wishes and worries, anything along those lines, it humanizes you. So it's more empathic to say, I hope this happens in the right way, than to say, I'm sure it'll happen in the right way. I've often told experts that every time you change the word confident to a word like hopeful, you're moving in the right direction, partly because you're acknowledging uncertainty, but also because you're becoming a person. You're not just an agency that's sure everything's going to be fine. You're a person that hopes you do it right, and that hopes it works out right, and that hopes other people are not damaged by the pesticide regime that you're administering. Similarly, I wish is more empathic than a definite answer. If you don't have a definite answer, I wish I had one is more empathic than I don't have one. Half credit if people ask you a question and you don't know the answer. Half credit for saying you don't know the answer rather than making it up, but full credit if you actually express the wish that you had the answer. God, I wish I knew the answer to that. And then, of course, if you can find out, tell them what you're doing to find out. And if you've been trying for 30 years to find out, and it's beyond the science to answer that question in any detail, then tell them that. But even if it's an unanswerable question, wishing you had the answer is way more empathic than simply saying, I don't have the answer. The negative ones, fears and regrets and worries, obviously regrets are unachievable wishes. It's what you wished that didn't happen. I'm sorry that the applicator didn't do it the way that she promised she'd do it. That's a regret. If you're in the future, it would have been a hope, but it didn't happen. So now it's a regret. Similarly, fears and worries are the flip side of hopes. their future oriented regrets are of course past oriented, but they're still about, you know, things that went wrong, or in the case of fears and worries, things that you're fearful or worried might go wrong or might happen. All of that is valuable. Number 10, ride the ambivalence seesaw is important and complicated, and let me see if I can make sense out of it. Whenever people are ambivalent, and people are not always ambivalent, and it's important to not ride an ambivalent seesaw if there isn't one, but whenever people are ambivalent, communication happens on a seesaw, risk communication or any communication. That is, if I am torn between X and Y, and that's what ambivalence means, I'm torn between two alternative opinions or two alternative actions, I'm torn between X and Y. Whenever that's true, if you say X, I will say Y. If you say Y, I will say X. That is, people go to the side of the ambivalence that is inadequately represented in their communication environment. Again, people are not always ambivalent, but if you have a real sense that, you know, you suspect that they are, and you can test for it, you know, if you go to the other side and they go to the opposite side, you know you are dealing with ambivalence. An example of this, for example, you know, and there are lots of examples. One that I kind of already addressed without describing it: if you let people vent, they eventually want you to talk. That's an ambivalence. You know, if you talk, they want you to shut up so they can yell at you. If you shut up so they can yell at you, they wind up wanting you to talk. Because they're torn. They want to yell at you, but they also want to hear what you have to say about what they yelled at you. So if you listen, I mean, the way to get them to want to listen is to listen, so that they get onto the other side of that ambivalence. Similarly, saying to someone, "I could certainly understand it if you don't want to talk about this," makes them more likely to want to talk about it. You've got to the other side of the ambivalence. If you express a worry, people are less likely to be worried. So whenever you sense there might be an ambivalence, test for it. And then if you find that, yes, indeed, they are in fact ambivalent, then make use of that. And get on the side of the seesaw you don't want them on. The advanced version of the advanced course is, as you move toward the fulcrum, toward the middle of the seesaw, you can move them toward the middle of the seesaw, where they are beginning to be able to see inconsistent points of view at the same time. And obviously, there is an ongoing technical seesaw between the risk of pests and the risks of pesticides. You can get on the side of that ambivalence that you don't want them on, and then move toward the fulcrum, so that as you move toward the fulcrum, hopefully they will move toward the fulcrum to keep that seesaw in balance, and you can meet in the middle, where adults live, where you're beginning to understand that, yes, pesticides are dangerous, and pests are also dangerous. And what we're trying to figure out is how to use pesticides in a way that minimizes the danger of the pesticide while also minimizing the danger of the pest. How do we compromise? And you can see that the seesaw is operating on my hands here. How do we compromise between those two, opposite concerns, the concern about pest risk and the concern about pesticide risk? That's a profound ambivalence that's always operating. If you're insisting that the pest is dangerous, they will keep insisting that the pesticide is dangerous. If you talk enough about the risk of the pesticide, they'll start to get interested in the risk of the pest. Then from that side, you can start moving toward the middle, as I say, where adults live. But again, bear in mind, people are not always ambivalent. I'm thinking, for example, about a bad divorce, where you're in the middle of getting divorced and you say to your soon to be ex, it's partly my fault. They're not going to say, yeah, it's partly my fault too. They're going to say, you're damn right, it's your fault. They're not ready for ambivalence. They're on one side only. But very, very often your attentives are ambivalent. And you need to notice that, or at least it's useful to notice that and address that, rather than imagining that their expressed point of view is unambivalent. It may well be half of what they're thinking. And to arouse the other half of what they're thinking, you need to ride the seesaw. Finally, number 11, acknowledge uncertainty. Uncertainty is a seesaw. If you say you're confident, they get more uncertain. I discovered this very early in my career as a consultant. If I said to a client, I'm really good at this. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm talking about. All you need to do is take my advice. The client got very worried about whether I was actually a good consultant. In contrast to that, if I said to the client with a confident tone, but uncertain content, I said, this is just my best intuition. This is, it's not a very good science, risk communication. I'm wrong sometimes. And the buck stops with you. You're going to have to decide, whether you want to take a chance on my recommendations or you want to take a chance on your intuition. And I'm not always right. I'm urging you to bet that I'm likelier to be right than your prior guesses about how to manage this controversy. But I'm not claiming certainty. Whenever I gave that shtick, clients got more confident. They trusted me more. They trusted my wisdom more when I claimed less wisdom. So acknowledging uncertainty, again, with a confident tone, I think is very good. The essence of what you're saying, you are a pesticide expert. The essence of what you're saying is being a pesticide expert doesn't mean I know everything about pesticides. Okay. It means I know a lot, but there's a lot I don't know. There's a lot nobody knows, and there's a lot that maybe somebody out there knows it, but I don't. And what you want to project is that, yeah, you have some uncertainties. You can, you're used to that. You're good at making decisions and making good decisions in the face of some uncertainty. But claiming certainty, I think more than likely with an outraged public, when you start claiming certainty, then they really smell a rat. Then, mistrust goes through the roof. So that's some of the advanced course. Again, let me pause and see if there are comments or questions. And then I'm going to do the last thing that I propose to do, which is to talk about six strategies, if I get to all six strategies for reducing outrage. But let me stop first and give people yet another chance to have comments or questions.
I see here that someone is agreeing with you. Public meetings can be very difficult because people tend to start feeling their oats and want to be perceived that they have given the state hell. Yep.
Yeah, and the challenge is to redefine that as part of the purpose of the meeting. Instead of them getting in the way of the meeting, that's one of the goals of the meeting, is to let them give you hell. Let them vent. And as I said earlier, their venting is them telling you what a jerk they think you are. And then later on, they will demand that you talk, and you start by telling them what a jerk they think you are. You echo the things that they've been venting. I'm not arguing that this is fun for you. I'm arguing that it tends to work. It works better than trying to stop them from venting. And, I think it helps to redefine their venting, their feeling their oats, as you say, and giving you hell. Redefine that as part of the value of the meeting rather than a waste of time.
Well, I have a question for you. Sure. Myself. You're teaching me how to communicate, which is wonderful, and how to use the correct terminology. How do I fix the expression on my face?
Well, I'm not sure I know the answer. Wendy, I think that's part of an empathic attitude. I mean, if you can actually, convince yourself that being angry is, at you is not dumb, being unsure whether pesticides are safe or not is not dumb. Even if I'm a smoker and I've, you know, I mean, one of the most common things my clients in all kinds of fields have said to me, and it showed up in one of the comments that I read during the break, where one of the most common things is, my God, how can somebody smoke cigarettes and still think that this other risk, you know, pesticide risk or the risk of the emissions from my factory is a big deal when it's so much less risky than smoking? And you know, what you have to do is, you know, one, bear in mind they like smoking and they don't like pesticides. So giving up smoking would be a cost and giving up pesticides would be a benefit. They're addicted to smoking. It's hard to give up. They would have no trouble at all giving up pesticides, or at least they think they would until they encountered pests in greater number. But also just technically, you know, they have a sound point to make, though they often make it. I have as much risk as I can afford to have as a smoker. Smokers have even more reason than non-smokers to worry about pesticides. Once I've taken on board that I'm gonna continue smoking, my toxicity risk, my risk budget is pretty full, and I have to be very, very careful about these smaller risks because I've decided to endure the big one. That's not irrational. What's irrational is to say if you're enduring a big one, you have no business enduring the small ones. That's crazy. You know, if I'm enduring the big ones, I have more reason not to want to endure the small ones. I think you have to kind of work to understand why they are not being stupid. It helps, I think, to remember, and for most of us, it doesn't take that much to remember situations in which we are outraged. You know, you buy a product and you take it home and it doesn't work. And you're furious and you want to yell at that salesperson and you want to tell them what a fool they are. And in the back of your mind, you know, they didn't make it not work. And you know that X percent of products don't work. And you know that you'll be, you know, you would be wiser to be nice to them and be empathic to the salesperson if you're trying to get him or her to replace the thing you bought. But you're outraged. Sort of finding your way to what you're like when you're too outraged to be nice is helpful. What you do about your face, I don't know. I mean, I think understanding how they feel and sort of genuinely trying to empathize how they feel is as good as it gets. Worst case, if you can't control your face and you know you can't control your face, then own it. Then say, I'm working really hard here because the me in me wants to yell back at you. You're yelling at me. You're making me feel terrible about myself. You're reminding me of all the times when my mother used to yell at me. And you're seeing it on my face that I want to yell back. And I'm not going to yell back for two reasons. One, that's not professional. And two, you're entitled to yell at me and I'm not entitled to yell back. You have a right to be as angry as you want to get. And I have an obligation to hear you and listen and be responsive. And I'm sorry that my face is showing some of how I'm feeling, but I'm working real hard to listen despite that feeling. That's, you know, that's better than pretending that the conflict between, you know, how you feel and how you look how you're acting is not really there. If the conflict is there and you can't control your face, then own it.
Jim says, wear my face mask.
That's right. That, you know, one of the main benefits of the pandemic, right? We don't have to worry about controlling our face, except on Zoom, of course, where, you know, my face is a dead giveaway.
I get frustrated when individuals are outraged, but they don't understand why they're outraged. Meryl Streep said that I can't eat apples that's got pesticides on it. So now I'm really upset. Well, but nothing really occurred to them. They're just like a lemming and wanting to be upset about something.
I suspect that's usually not what's going on, even when you think it's what's going on. I mean, most people have no shortage in their lives of things to get upset about. And there is a kind of a law of conservation of outrage. I mean, you know, we only, I mean, some people are more prone to get upset than other people, but that's a personality trait that's enduring. And I am as splenetic as I was last week. So if I'm angry about something new, I had to kind of redirect some outrage from something else. The same is true of fear. You know, if I, you know, after 9/11, people were less upset about pollution, you know, including pesticides, because they were more upset about terrorism, and they, you know, so they diminished some of their other concerns to make room for the new source of outrage. You know, so there, you know, there is a law of conservation of outrage, but very few people are in the market for new reasons to be outraged. You know, such that if Meryl Streep says something is upsetting, you know, when I wasn't upset about it because Meryl Streep says so, I become upset. That, I mean, I won't say that never happens, because, you know, basically nothing never happens. But I, you know, I would look deeper. You know, why was I willing to follow Meryl Streep's lead? And I'm willing to bet something was going on. Now, it might not actually be about pesticides. It might be about your agency more generally. It might be about that venue more generally. You know, the you know, if my neighbor is spraying his grass, you know, and I'm really upset about my neighbor spraying his grass, one possibility is that, you know, this is not my first fight with that neighbor. You know, and I'm prone to be upset about her spraying her grass because I've been angry at her about so many other things.
Yes,
so it may not be that. what it's represented as being, and you know, you may need to probe a little bit empathically without, you know, without being too intrusive, you know, but something's going on there other than having heard Meryl Streep on the television.
Gotcha. I have another one here. What do you suggest doing if you know the person is lying? Do you bring it up right away, or do you wait?
Okay, we have to make a distinction between lying and mistaken. And by and large, there are exceptions. I mean, there are people who lie all the time. There are professional activists who don't lie all the time, but lie self-awarely. There are officials who lie self-awarely. They're often my clients. You know, I will bet you that if you think really hard, you will be able to think of times when your agency required you to lie. You know, we don't have any data that dimethyl meatloaf is toxic, when in fact you do have some data, but it's pretty weak data, and it's only toxic in high doses, and you don't want to go there. You'd rather lie and say you don't have any data that dimethyl meatloaf is toxic. So it's not like lying is rare, okay? But lying, especially outraged people lying, as opposed to professionals, you know, people who are, you know, sort of self-awarely lying because it's their job, which is, you know, when you lie, it's because it's your job. But when outraged people lie, it's usually because they're too outraged to think straight. And then it's a very short-term phenomenon, because the, you know, cognitive dissonance, which I think some of you probably have heard about, comes into play. And the lie is very brief, and then I come to believe it. And you know, again, almost everybody can think of moments in their life when you said something because it was convenient to say, you made a claim that really wasn't true because you had reasons to want to make the claim. And the more often you made the claim, the more you believed it. This is true about the past. I mean, you tell a story about yourself and you embroider the story, and pretty soon it's what you remember. You know, it's no longer a fiction, it's your false memory. That's true of especially true of outraged people, that they may start out making a claim they know is false, but by the third time they make it, they believe it. Whether they're actually self-awarely lying or they're not, they're just mistaken. In my experience, it is usually wise to treat them as mistaken. I would address the error, and as you know from what I've said already, I wouldn't be in a hurry to address the error. I mean, that comes later in the interaction when you've earned the right. But even after you've earned the right to address the error, I would address it as an error, not as a lie. Now, particularly in a public meeting, if there's somebody in the meeting who's lying, I would address it as an error, and the odds are very good that the audience can suss out that they're lying. And that's fine. The absolute ideal relationship with the most outraged, most dishonest activist is for you to be responsive and respectful. Remember earlier on, I said you interact with fanatics while the attentives watch. And you're trying to persuade the attentives that you are listening seriously and thoughtfully and responsively to the fanatics. So you got a fanatic and the fanatic is being so outraged and very dishonest. I'm going to call the fanatic Susan, my first wife's name. She enjoys that that little shtick I have. And there's Susan and she's acting like a real jerk. Now, if you get into a fight with Susan, if you treat Susan like the jerk she's acting like, the audience will unite behind Susan. She becomes a whistleblower. If, on the other hand, you are very responsive to Susan, and Susan keeps interrupting, and Susan keeps hijacking the meeting, and other people want to ask questions, and they have much more respectful questions to ask, and much more thoughtful questions to ask, and Susan keeps lying, and Susan keeps yelling, and you keep treating Susan decently, and everybody is rolling their eyes, wishing you would tell Susan to shut up. Okay, that's absolutely ideal. You can't do better in a meeting than to have everybody on your side wishing you would tell Susan to shut up.
I like that.
Anything else, Wendy, or shall we? Shall I go back to or go on to the six principle strategy?
Let's move forward.
Okay. Then Zach, can we have the next slide? Okay. This is the first of the six strategies: to stake out the middle rather than the extreme. And the most important point I want to make here is that risk controversies are not symmetrical. In any fight between whether something is dangerous or safe, okay, and it's obviously not a dichotomy, how dangerous or how safe. The extreme argument that it's dangerous is much more acceptable than the extreme argument that it's safe. Okay, so exaggerating how bad the risk is, which is what activists do and what outraged people do, is much more tolerable than exaggerating how safe the risk is. And if you think about it, that's not crazy. I mean, we titrate smoke alarms to overreact, right? I mean, if there's a fire and the smoke alarm doesn't go off, that's a very major problem. If the smoke alarm goes off when there wasn't a fire, that's a comparatively minor problem, So we adjust the smoke alarm so it goes off too much and doesn't miss any fires. We similarly adjust activists so they go off too much and don't miss a big risk. It's built into our DNA. It's built into how people respond to controversies. The scary side gets to exaggerate and the reassuring side doesn't. Now what follows from that is if a fight is well fought, it will be a fight between the extreme version of the alarming side and the moderate version, the middle version of the reassuring side. So if it's very dangerous versus very safe, very dangerous works. If it's a little dangerous versus a little safe, those turn out to be pretty much the same position, and a little safe is fine. If it's very dangerous versus a little safe, if it's the moderate safety position versus the extreme alarmist position, it's a fair fight. So if you're reassuring people, you want to stake out the middle. Now, by the way, it's only if you're reassuring people. You know, I mean, regulators are sometimes on the other side. You're sometimes saying, my God, you're saying to an applicator, stop misusing this pesticide. This is incredibly dangerous. Or you're talking about the risk of the pest rather than the pesticide. There are occasions when you have kind of, not totally free reign, you still don't want to lie, but when you have the opportunity to be pretty dramatic and even exaggerated about how bad the risk is. But when you're on the outrage management side, then you have to be very, very careful to stake out the middle. What that means in practice is this: make a list of all the alarming things that might be said that are true. Okay, all the valid points, all the factoids that, you know, sound valid, they're true, even though they may be misinterpreted, they're, you know, on the, you know, they're actually true, and explaining why they're not as scary as they sound is that, you know, that's hard. You know, make a list of all the alarming things that somebody could say without lying, and include them all in your reassuring message. Okay, that's how you stake out the middle when you're on the outrage management side of a controversy. If I can think of anything alarming to say that you're not acknowledging, then you have not yet staked out the middle. And again, it's only what you do. You can't expect the alarmist to acknowledge all the reassuring information. They're not gonna do that. They're gonna exaggerate and dramatize the alarming information. But you need to include both the alarming and the reassuring information if you're going to succeed in reassuring outraged people. Now, the last thing I want to say about point number one is people will use it against you. You know, I mean, if you're in a fight, if you're you're in a debate or an argument or a public meeting, there are only two things they can say about about an alarming piece of information. If you admit it, they'll say, even the agency admits. If you don't admit it, they'll say, what the agency doesn't want you to know is, they're going to use that alarming piece of information, that alarming factoid, either way. They're either going to use it as an example of the fact that you can't be trusted, or they're going to use it as something that even you are willing to acknowledge. You know, and you know, the question for you is, which one is stronger ammunition for your opponents? And the stronger ammunition is if you don't acknowledge it, and they get to use it against you as something you're not admitting. So you admit all the other side's best arguments. It's very, very hard to persuade yourself to do it. But if you try it once or twice, you're gonna be stunned more often than not at how well it takes the wind out of their sails. You know, if you can start a meeting, the main thrust of which, in your opinion, is to reassure people that this particular pesticide use is tolerable. If you start the meeting with half a dozen reasons why it might not be tolerable, and say, all right, this is the strongest negative case, and the burden of proof is on me now to prove that despite these truths, it's still okay to apply this pesticide in the way we're doing it. Then you're framing the middle, you're framing the controversy in a way that maximizes the likelihood of achieving outrage management. Okay, any questions about number one before I go on to number two? And it doesn't matter if I don't get to all of them. They're all on the website.
Nope, not yet.
Okay.
Moving on.
Okay, moving on to number two. Acknowledge your prior misbehavior. Zach, can I have the next slide? Acknowledge your prior misbehavior. Now, by prior misbehavior, I don't just mean things that your boss would consider misbehavior. I mean anything that, in the judgment of the audience, reflects badly on you. It may be a mistake. It may be, you know, something that looks to them like a mistake. It may be something that, you know, the downside of something that was on balance the right thing to do, but it had a real downside, and that downside needs to be acknowledged. You know, whatever the negatives are, this second outrage reduction strategy is to acknowledge these prior negatives. And they may be about exactly the thing you're discussing, but they may not. They may be, you know, what your agency did wrong in this community 5 years ago that has nothing to do with this pesticide or nothing to do with any pesticide. But it's what's on this outraged person's mind when they interact with your agency is the way you screwed up this other thing in their judgment. So whatever the prior misbehavior is. Now, it's kind of obvious, not often done, but it's kind of obvious that you should acknowledge it if they know about it. Okay, it's already on their mind, and acknowledging it does no harm. But I'm making a stronger case than that. I'm saying acknowledge it even if they don't know about it, especially if it's on the public record. Now, I think it takes a saint to acknowledge it if nobody knows, if the only person that knows this negative piece of information is you, and there's no way they're ever going to find out, then, you know, still honorable to acknowledge it, but that's more advanced than the advanced course. That's the saintly course that I never got to take, much less teach. But what I am talking about is acknowledging prior misbehavior that is on the public record, even though the person you're talking to or the audience you're talking to doesn't know about it, because they're gonna find out, okay, or they're likely to find out. And here's the math. A piece of negative information does approximately 20 times as much harm if somebody else blows the whistle on you than it does if you blow the whistle on yourself. It's 20 times as harmful to keep something secret and have it revealed by an opponent than it is to reveal it yourself. Okay, now that's a rule of thumb. It's not. You know, maybe it's 19 sometimes, maybe it's 21 sometimes, but 20 is a rough measure of how much more harm it does to have a whistleblower reveal it than to have you reveal it. So you can do math with that. It follows from that in order to have secrecy pay for itself, you have to have a 95% chance of successfully keeping the secret. You know, if the odds are less than 1 in 20 that they're going to find out, then don't tell them. And, you know, one time in 20 or less than one time in 20, say one time in 100, they find out. It does 20 times as much harm as if you'd told them, but you're still ahead of the game.
You should have told my children that before they started their malarkey.
Because you catch them all the time,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it is worse. You're right.
You know, so, I mean, if the odds are only 1 in 10 that they're going to find out, you know, you should tell them, because, you know, if they find out 1 time in 10, or, you know, there's a long list of things you're not telling them, and they find out 1/10 of those things, that does 20 times as much harm, and you'd have been better off revealing all your prior misbehaviors, all the negative content that you've got. So this is the second recommendation, or at least it's the first half of the second recommendation, to acknowledge all the bad stuff, certainly acknowledge the bad stuff they know, but also acknowledge the bad stuff they might find out. The second half of number two is to acknowledge it apologetically. And I'm not gonna take the time, because it would take the rest of the time I have, to talk about how to apologize. But I wanna at least very, very quickly, without elaboration, run through the steps in apologizing, and there are six. Step number one is to admit you did it. Step number two is to let them vent. Step three is to say you're sorry. And saying you're sorry has subcomponents. It includes a component of regret. I wish I'd done it right. It includes a component of sympathy. I'm sorry this happened to you. It includes a component of responsibility. It's not just you wish it hadn't happened. You know, you understand that you had a role in making this bad thing happen. So saying you're sorry is number three. Number four is making it right part one, which is to compensate your victims. A bad thing happened. Can you know, part of making it right is compensation. But importantly, these things are in order. If you make it right without apologizing, it feels like a bribe. It doesn't feel like compensation. It feels like a bribe, and people get more outraged. So you have to apologize before you compensate in order for the compensation to be an outrage reducer. Step five is the rest of making it right, which is to improve. People don't want you just to compensate them for what you did wrong. They want you to make a case that you learned something from it and you're going to do it wrong less often in the future. And that improvement is part of apologizing. And the sixth and final step is to do a penance. That you guys are regulators. You're very accustomed to imposing penances, or at least to imposing fines on people. And, you know, I routinely used to advise the regulated community, the companies that you regulate, that, you know, as the last step in an apology process, they should reframe your fine, not just as a fine, but as a penance for their misbehavior. Because as any good Catholic will tell you, you can't be forgiven until you've done a penance. So those six steps are the process of earning forgiveness. But obviously the first step is to say you did it, and that, you know, or to say it happened, or to say it's true. And that's what acknowledging prior misbehavior is all about. So again, I'll pause before going on to number three and see if anyone wants to say anything.
I think we got something. Hang on. Oh, I see. They're talking about our maybe uniforms or car vehicles being an area that could probably incite individuals because they see the punishment coming out of the car walking towards them, I guess. So they're discussing about parking farther away so that no one can see our vehicle. So trying to prevent a hostile situation.
Well, the problem, of course, Wendy, and I think you all know this, is you know, it'll either prevent the hostile situation or it'll make it sound like you're trying to hide the hostile situation, and that'll make it worse. If you can apply pesticides or show up for to a venue where pesticides are being applied and have nobody the wiser and nobody's upset anyway, why would you want them to get upset by the appearance of your car? On the other hand, if they're already upset and your car is going to be the trigger for them to start venting, then the question you need to ask is, well, how long do you want to stop the venting? You know, and think about the vent metaphor literally. I mean, you know, if you've got a pressure relief valve that's venting gas under pressure, the last thing you want to do is stop the vent, and you know, then you explode the tank. You know, the purpose of the pressure relief valve is to vent the gas in the tank so the tank doesn't explode. And similarly, if people are outraged, you know, why would you want that outrage not to be vented until the community explodes? So if it's your car that is the precipitating moment for the venting, you know, you may want to delay that until 3 days from now so you can rehearse, or you may want to hide the car today, but you don't want to hide it forever, because eventually that venting is part of what you want to happen, not what you want to prevent. Wendy, anything else to move on?
Nope. I think we can move on.
Okay, Zach, next slide, please. Number three is to acknowledge your current problems. Now, I'm a creature of the 1950s, and I grew up loving a mathematician who was also a writer of song parodies named Tom Lehrer. And I don't know how many of you know Tom Lehrer. You probably, if you know him,
I do.
You know
him. Oh, good. That's how I learned the chemical chart.
Ah, okay. But one of Tom Lehrer's songs was Be Prepared. And a line in that song is, I'm not going to sing it. Be prepared and be careful not to do your good deed when there's no one watching you. And that is the core lesson of number three. You do not want to solve problems while people aren't watching. Okay. And the reason you don't want to solve problems while people aren't watching, in an environment in which there's a lot of outrage, is because if they're not watching, they will not believe that you solved the problem. If outrage is high, skepticism is also high, mistrust is high, And in situations of high mistrust and high skepticism, it is very much in your interest to get your stakeholders there before you solve the problem, so that they will find the solution believable. Let me quickly give you an example from very early on in my consulting. I consulted with a refinery that had, you know, a significant community relations problem. And one of the things they decided they would do, and not for technical reasons, but for community relations reasons, they decided anything that happened on site that was detectable off site, might be a flare or a siren, anything at all, they would call the local police precinct and tell the desk sergeant. So if a neighbor called and said, you know, what's going on, the desk sergeant could say, oh yeah, the refinery called, and here's the story, here's what that's all about. In the first 5 months of this new policy, this public affairs policy, it's not a technical policy, the company made 19 calls to the police, you know, telling them, you know, here's what's happening, telling them about some 19 different things that were detectable, were visible offsite. And then after 5 months, one day, there was an acrid odor wafting through the community. And lots of people called the police and they said, what's that smell? And the desk sergeant said, I don't know, but it can't be the refinery or they would have called. Okay. Now they earned that with 19 technically unnecessary phone calls. Now, obviously, if it turned out it was the refinery, if they had a problem and didn't tell anybody, all that accumulated trust would be forfeit. It's not like if you tell us about problems, you earn the right to lie about one later. Kind of like a mulligan in golf. That's not the way it works. But if you establish that you routinely tell us what's going on, you tell us about problems before you have solved them, you establish as a rebuttable presumption that something that happens you that you haven't told us about must not be a problem or must not be your problem. Okay, and that's money in the bank. That's one of a bunch of reasons why it's useful to acknowledge your current problems. One reason is the rebuttable presumption. If you haven't said something about it, about this being a problem, you know, then it's not your problem. The second, and the one that I mentioned at the very beginning of number three, is it establishes a rebuttable presumption. That was the first. It makes the solution credible. You want me to watch you flail. You know, that is, the way problem solving normally works. You try something, it doesn't work. You try something else, it doesn't work. You try something else, looks like it's working maybe. You expand the pilot to field status, you dot the I's and cross the T's, and little by little, you've got the problem under control. And what normally organizations do is they do all of that behind closed doors. They do all of that. And this is true of companies, but it's equally true of government agencies. You don't want us to watch you flail. You don't want us to watch you try something that doesn't work. So you try things secretly, or at least, you know, quietly. And after it succeeds, you call your hostile stakeholders and say, got that one solved. And they don't believe you because they weren't there when you were flailing. So that's the second reason. The third reason results from the fact that problem solving is not dichotomous. You don't usually solve the whole problem. You solve pieces of the problem. You solve as much of the problem as you can, or you solve as much of the problem as you need to. The reason you want me watching is I will define the problem as the problem as it existed when I got there. So if there's a cleanup, for example, there's been a pesticide spill and you're supervising the cleanup, if the neighborhood gets there after 90% of the cleanup is done, they will define the remaining 10% as the whole cleanup. And they will demand an order of magnitude better cleanup than they would have demanded if they'd been there from the get-go. So, you know, given that the difficulty of the cleanup increases, you know, exponentially as you get closer and closer to the solution, the last thing you want is to have me there only at the end when it's nearly impossible to get that last molecule of dimethyl meatloaf out of the topsoil, or out of the groundwater. So you want me there when it's easy, when you're doing the easy part of the cleanup, so that by the time you get to the impossible part, I see it as having mostly been cleaned up. Okay. So those are the three reasons for acknowledging your current problems and solving them while we watch. I have only just 2 or 3 minutes left, right, Wendy?
Yes. Yep.
So let me just identify the other three. Number four is discuss your achievements with humility, or another way of saying that is give away the credit. And yet another way of saying that is try to be a responsive organization rather than a responsible organization. That is, instead of saying we did the right thing because it's right, try to say as often as it's true, we did the right thing because you, our stakeholders, made us do it. Now, I'm not telling you when to give in to your stakeholders and when not to. What I'm telling you is if, in fact, you are giving in to your stakeholders, don't piss away that outrage management benefit by pretending you did it solo. You did it sua sponte, on your own. If you did it because you were under pressure, own up to the pressure. Being the one who gave you pressure is going to minimize my outrage. That's number four in a nutshell. Next slide, number five in a nutshell, share control and be accountable. Sharing control is one of the most powerful tools of diminishing outrage. If I'm in control, I feel way less outraged than if you're in control. That's the difference between going skiing and sliding down a mountain on slippery sticks that somebody strapped to the bottoms of your feet. It's who's in control and who decided to do it. Both control and voluntariness are critical. Accountability is halfway towards sharing control. If you can't let me be in control, you can at least be accountable to me. So that, for example, letting me drive is putting me in control. Letting me backseat drive, letting me watch you drive and yell at you that you're a rotten driver, that's accountability. Accountability is not as good as sharing control, but it's halfway there. And if you're unwilling or unable to share control, accountability does a lot of good. And finally, number six, Zach, pay attention to unvoiced concerns and underlying motives. If you may or may not be able to accuse people of their underlying concerns and underlying motives and unvoiced concerns. I mean, you don't want to be too obtrusive. That's a point I've made again and again and again, too intrusive. But if you kind of know that, you know, they claim to be worried about X, but they're really worried about Y, you need to find ways to get Y onto the table. Or if under the table is too intrusive, at least into the room. You can't manage outrage about something that's not in the room, that's not there to be talked about. However, you have to deflect it. You have to make it there so you can talk about it. Similarly for underlying motives, maybe I'm outraged. Maybe it's about ego. Maybe it's about greed, and not just greed for money, but, you know, I'm a politician wanting to get reelected. I'm head of a community group and I want to keep my office. Those are all greed too. I'm an activist and I want new members. Maybe it's about ideology. Maybe it's about revenge. You know, your agency treated my organization horribly a few years ago, and this is my chance to treat you horribly. So getting those underlying motives onto the table, maybe not onto the table, but at least in your head so that you can address them is number six. And now I'm done. Let me just reiterate the very basic point. Okay. The very basic point is when you're talking to outraged people, what's going on is mostly about the outrage. It's secondarily about the hazard. They do misperceive the hazard, but they don't misperceive the hazard because you have failed to educate them properly. They misperceive the hazard because their outrage makes them want to misperceive the hazard. And they will resist changing that misperception until you do something to manage the outrage. And what I've tried to do is introduce some of the strategies you might try to manage the outrage. If you like this stuff, go on to my website. There's a whole lot more there. And I will stop for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very, very much. And yes, your website is quite extensive. It's actually so honorable of you to just give away all your work, but been very, very helpful, particularly when we are in these conflicted situations and we are supposed to be the professionals. So I think I'll be wearing a mask even when this COVID thing's done.
My wife tells me I look better with a mask.
Anybody have anything else for Mr. Sandman before he leaves us?
Well, I just like a lot of thank yous. It's all good information as we navigate the stew of risk management. So,
okay, my pleasure.
Okay. Good anybody luck have any questions before we go?
Getting a lot of thank yous.
Thank you, sir.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Excellent. Thanks, Wendy. Bye-bye.
Yeah.